Okay, everybody. Welcome. I'm Brian McKinnon. This is President Archibald. We're here to talk to you a little bit about stream ecology and stream health, and it's a very, very broad topic. So we'll just kind of skim the surface. Essentially, you know, when I go to a lot of talks, my first question is like, why do I care? What am I here for? Like, hook me. Like, why is this important? One thing to point out that when people are thinking about why streams and freshwater ecosystems are important, they typically think of, you know, provisioning services. Oftentimes people talk about ecosystem services. So what services do these ecosystems provide to humans? It's a very kind of anthropocentric way of looking at an ecosystem, but they do provide a number of, you know, economic services, and that's typically what most people think of first. You know, the universal language amongst humans is kind of money, one way or the other. And so, you know, some people were talking about things like food and drinking water, irrigation, hydroelectricity, which, you know, is powering all the lights in here right now, for instance. You know, commodities, goods. That's typically what most people are thinking of. Irrigation, employment, you know, transportation. But can anybody else think of some other services that a freshwater ecosystem might provide us?
Maintains our mental health.
Yes, and that's a very difficult thing to value. There's a whole field of environmental science, you know, and economics where they try to actually put a number on some of these other services that these ecosystems provide. Anything else?
Place for salmon to breed.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, those salmon have a lot of intrinsic value. Again, hard to quantify. Easy in some ways, but harder in others. You know, spiritual. There's other things that, you know, we're talking about here. So regulating services, so these are things that help regulate the ecosystem processes that are provided by freshwater ecosystems. So flood regulation is a big one. Nutrient cycling, they help to essentially regulate these other processes that are super important to the rest of, to aquatic ecosystems as well as to terrestrial ecosystems as well. Climate regulation, if you look at maps of, you know, if you're into wine, for instance, you might look at some maps of distributions of wineries, and you might note that they tend to be on the, you know, windward side of a lot of larger freshwater bodies. Not in all cases, obviously, but in the United States, it's quite remarkable the number that you might see in the Finger Lakes and the Great Lakes. They tend to be in those areas because the freshwater bodies create an amazing little microclimate that's just right for certain kinds of grape growing. Some other things are supporting, like primary production, so we're just talking about photosynthesis. Soil formation, these are things that support other parts of the ecosystem. Nutrient cycling, and of course there's a cultural aspect here. You know, recreational, a lot of people like to fish. How do you value that beyond simply saying, well, you know, we make X amount of money in this state on fishing tourism. But, you know, there's also a lot of value in just wanted to be out there and go fishing. I know myself, I'm a big fisherman. Spiritual, educational, aesthetic, a lot of artists, you know, might be on board with this one. So anyways, the point is, there's a lot of reasons. This is just a, you know, a subset of the many, many services that this freshwater ecosystems provide us. So they provide all of these things for us, but they're pretty rare, right? They make up just a teeny tiny fraction of the Earth's surface. You know, so, you know, you think about the Earth as the blue planet, right? Does anybody know, like, remember from, you know, third grade, how much of the Earth's surface is actually covered by water?
70?
Yeah, 71%, 70, yeah. The majority of the Earth's surface, right? So, we talked about this in a prior presentation, you know, so they're home to about 10% of species, and 40% of all the fish, right? That's a lot. And yet, the teeny tiny amount of actual available habitat. So what we're looking at here is obviously the Earth, and we've taken that 71% of the surface, the Earth's surface, and we've now condensed it into a sphere. So all the salt water, all the fresh water, everywhere, all into one big ball is about 850 miles across in diameter. That's all of it, just into a ball. Now, if we take out all the salt water and leave only fresh water, we have this little ball here. Mm-hmm. This is about 150 miles in diameter. Mm-hmm. Then if we take out all of the water associated with groundwater or frozen in ice caps, we take all of that out and just talk about lakes and rivers. Mm. Can you see that little teeny dot? Yeah, it's kind of hard to see. It's 35 miles in diameter. Now, that almost looks unbelievable. You know, some of you might think that can't be right. Cannot be right. Well, think about a severe going 35 miles up in the air. You know, it's actually a fair amount of volume. But still, it makes a point that all of this, all of those services, 40% of fish species are all in this little drop of water. This is really precious stuff. And this will, there we go. And so, you know, the World Wildlife Federation, a bunch of people have tried to do their best to look at which biomes are the most threatened, essentially, ranking them. And kind of consistently, especially in the last 20 years, it seems like freshwater ecosystems are often rising to the top, unfortunately, but being the most threatened, more so than marine or terrestrial environments. And if you're just looking in North America, so you got 877 times in terms of the extinction rate relative to the natural background rate. So they look a long, long time ago, and they look at the rate of extinction, like 1,000 years ago, before there were humans running around. And then they compare the current extinction rate, and they say, well, we're 877 times the amount. We're losing species at 877 times the rate, which is kind of a hard number to really wrap your mind around. And so we're talking about an 84% decline in freshwater species since 1970s, so that's just, you know, the last 50 years or so. So, you know, a depressing litany of figures, but it you know, all making a point that we have this precious resource, so many things depend on it, and unfortunately we damaged it. And so now we've got all these kind of negative effects here. And migratory freshwater fish have declined 80% in the last 50 years. So, you know, these are all unfortunate side effects of human development and human impacts. And so we oftentimes are trying to assess stream health, assess the degree to which humans have impacted a stream system. And this figure here is supposed to be kind of overwhelming. You're not supposed to digest all of this. This is to point out that stream health is very complicated, very dynamic, constantly changing, and it depends on so many different factors. You got this biotic factor, just mean living factor, you know. So anything that's living, you know, the bugs, the fish, the trees, the plants, all these things. And keep in mind that this kind of complicated looking diagram is a gross oversimplification of what's actually happening. If you're really going to represent the true complexity of the system, you'd have a lot more of these arrows in, but you'd also have a lot of interactions between them and a lot of kind of feedback mechanisms, kind of loops between these two, where the biota can affect the flow regime, and the flow regime can affect the biota. By that I mean, for instance, when we talk about, you know, these freshwater ecosystems, we can include the riparian zones, which are the nearby stream areas that are essentially part of the stream health. So when they overtop their banks and flood their floodplains, you know, that's one way to kind of measure where these riparian zones begin and end. And, you know, if we go and we modify the riparian zones and, say, chop down all the trees, that can have a big impact on the velocity of water, the frequency and magnitude of flooding events, and vice versa. So the flow regime can very much alter the biota in the stream. Large woody debris in streams, for instance. All these big trees that grow around here, they fall in the streams. It's an integral part of the aquatic habitat, and that very much modifies how the water moves through it, and modifies how the biota, how the fish and the and the bugs and the plants, how they exist in the system as well. So, we're talking about measuring human impacts, right? And we're talking about how changes and land use effects can affect watershed resources. So, you know, there's a ton of different ways humans can come and affect a freshwater ecosystem. We're not going to cover them all. We'll just consider land use change being one of them. So, let's say we have some development in an area, and that's going to have a bunch of different effects. Here's a small subset of what you might expect to find. You know, changes in hydrology, just meaning changes in stream flow, changes in water quality. So, looking at chemical changes within the water column. Stream morphology, we're just talking about the shape of the stream, its width, its depth, that sort of thing, meander bend lengths, and there's a whole bunch of different ways to measure its shape, but that's essentially what we're talking about. And of course, the ecology of plants and animals. So let's take that example of development. A lot of concrete, a lot of roofs, a lot of cars, a lot of essentially impervious surfaces where, we get rainfall and it's not really infiltrating like we might expect it to do in a natural system. And of course, that's going to have a lot of side effects. And so on the left here, you can see this is kind of a more natural representation of what you might expect to find. So this is an accounting and a natural system of what we might expect to see in terms of how much of the rainfall is, quote, lost to evapotranspiration. On average, across the U.S., it's going to vary, don't get me wrong, but in most places in the humid U.S., you would expect to see about 40% would be lost to evapotranspiration. Not lost, but used for evapotranspiration. And then, about a quarter of it would go to infiltration, and then the other quarter would go to actual deep groundwater inputs. And then you have, 10% or so would actually run off and go into our fresh surface water bodies. That's what you'd expect to find. But we go in, we throw in all of this development here, and we get pretty big changes. A 10% decline in evapotranspiration, because there's no trees to act as essentially straws, sucking all the soil water out and pumping it into the atmosphere. But we also have a pretty big change in the runoff. A big, big, big change in how much of that water is making it to our surface water bodies. And so that ends up causing some pretty big changes in the hydrographs or the hydrologic regime. And so when we talk about a hydrologic regime, we're usually talking about frequency, magnitude, timing, duration of flows. And so the hydrograph just means you've got time on the x-axis, and here you've got flow, usually measured in the United States anyways, in cubic feet per second. So you can kind of imagine a cubic foot of water. And if you've got 10 of them, they're all moving past this point in the stream at that time, per second. And you can actually, if you can visualize a cubic foot, you can actually do a pretty good job of estimating the actual flow rate of the stream just visually. You can get pretty close once you get a little bit of practice. But does anybody have any idea which of these two? Anybody have any guesses as to which one of these two stream systems is the developed system? The green or the blue, what would you say?
Green.
So these two streams are, like this one's in Bellevue, for instance. They're very close to each other. The only real difference, they're very similar watershed sizes. Does everybody know what a watershed is, probably. And there's very, very similar watershed sizes. So the only real difference is one is rural and one is in a developed watershed. So, the audience was correct. The green one is indeed the developed one. And so basically what ends up happening is you can kind of see, you take all this kind of slower moving water here, and you're kind of redistributing it in time. So you take that volume here and put it up here. It's gotten kind of redistributed such that you have a much higher peak flow. The peak flow in the Wapping Creek here is about 9 versus Mercer up here is almost 25. That's a huge, huge difference. And that has a lot of side effects to it. So not, you know, not only are the peaks higher, but the total volume of runoff is also typically higher in a developed scenario. You just have more water running off. It's not just the timing of it. It's also just the sheer amount of it flowing. So you also have a shorter time to peak, which is pretty typical. And in this case, it's not a huge difference, but it's about half a day or so between the peak, which is a, you know, it's a little hard to distinguish exactly where this real peak was, but it's about a half a day's difference in terms of when does that peak flow occur in the exact same rainstorm. And so what you end up with, of course, if you have these really high peak flows. You have these really high peak flows, of course, you get when the large flooding events, more runoff, you have higher transport capacity. So a natural stream system has an innate ability to carry sediment. And as you have more flow, you have a higher capacity for that river to transport sediment downstream. And as you increase its ability to carry sediment, because it just has more power, more velocity, more shear stress, you also tend to cause a lot of degradation. And I'll explain a little bit more about that in a second, but essentially what we're saying is the first thing oftentimes that a stream will do if its transport capacity is really, really high and it's really, really hungry now, is it eats its own bed away. So it tends to just get vertically down. And so that's, and as you have that happening, you also end up lowering the water table as you go down, 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 down. So right now the banks are, instead of being laid back like this, the stream banks are starting to go like this and getting more and more vertical right now. And as they get more vertical, they get more unstable. And as I mentioned, the water table start to drop. Well, a lot of native vegetation, their roots only go so deep. And so once the water table drops, all of a sudden the native vegetation is having a hard time. They're not able to access the water table like they used to. And a lot of invasive species are invasive because they have a much deeper taproot. They can establish and they can survive. And so they tend to take over, and so then you end up with a not only an altered stream channel, but an altered riparian area. And it makes it very difficult to restore if your water tables are so low. And like I said, so here's some photos of bank erosion. So you can see that's pretty severe. And there's all sorts of pictures of houses falling in and barns and things as this process of stream degradation and incision has progressed. And you can see here's a really good shot of these very unstable, very steep undercut stream banks, and those lead to a lot of sedimentation. Erosion is a natural process. It's a good thing in streams. Streams need to do that. It's how they create a diversity of habitats. It's how they mobilize and sort sediment. And well-sorted sediment is really important if you're, for instance, a salmon. You want to lay some eggs. You need just the right size pebbles, so that your eggs can survive. Because you're looking for a certain amount of what they call hyporheic flow. So you're looking for that flow to flow through that gravel, essentially, and provide enough oxygen to the eggs so they don't suffocate. But if you get blankets of very fine sediments being eroded from the stream banks and transported downstream, they tend to fill in all those little interstitial spaces in the gravel, and then choking off the flow, and therefore choking off all the oxygen to the salmon eggs. Which is obviously bad if you're a salmon. If you have less infiltration, if you can go back and visually in your mind and kind of imagine going back to that original slide where I was kind of contrasting the natural versus the developed scenario, and we have a much less infiltration of water, much more runoff, well, you end up with less of that infiltrated water going to your groundwater aquifers. And therefore, later in the summer, you have lower and lower base flows. In other words, lower and lower low flows. So less of that rainfall went into storage, long-term storage. that could slowly drain out and provide during hotter summer months with, when you have dry conditions, you end up with situations like this. And this is very difficult for a fish to potentially survive in a situation where they have such low flows. Not only is it decreasing the habitable area, there's just very little actual available habitat. You know, the wetted perimeter is so small that it's very difficult, but also there's much less water. And so the less water, the easier it is to heat it up. And then all of a sudden you get spikes in stream temperatures, then you got huge drops in dissolved oxygen, and that's also obviously a big issue. And so a lot of these things can be kind of summarized in something called Lane's diagram here. And so most stream systems are in a natural state of what we call dynamic equilibrium. So this is saying, essentially, that you kind of envision this as a big scale here. On one side we have sediments, on the other we have water. Now in this scenario we're talking about here with land use change and a lot more runoff, that means we have a lot more water on this side of the scale, right? And that would tip the scale downwards. And all of a sudden we'd be kind of wandering from this kind of dynamic equilibrium point in the middle towards degradation. And if we contrast that with a situation where we say, I don't know, did a bunch of logging in a watershed, or a bunch of farming, and we weren't real conscientious about how we were managing sediment, you might have a ton of sediment pouring into a stream. And the more sediment you have pouring into a stream, well, that's going to it's going to tip the scale down on this side, and this little needle is going to migrate towards the aggradation side, meaning now it's going to go vertically up. Instead of incising down and eating its way down, now it's going to start spilling up and causing a lot of potential flooding issues, and you know, a lot of issues regarding sedimentation, etc. And it's, you know, some other things that impact this, of course, are sediment size and stream slope. The steeper you get here, the more degradation you might have. And same with sediment. So it's not just an issue of sediment quantity, it's an issue of sediment size. You can see if we slide these either direction, we can tip the scales too. So a big point of this is that streams aren't in a static state of equilibrium. They're always being perturbed by something. There's always some natural disturbance, a fire, a flood, something's happening. But typically this needle is just going to kind of oscillate between this zone of dynamic equilibrium down here, you know, maybe between here. It's when humans really come in and cause a real state change that we get these huge changes in, you know, that either result in degradation or aggradation. And another impact, of course, when we're talking about land use change and development, of course, is pollution. That's a real obvious one. And so we're going to try to come up with a way we can measure all these impacts in a stream system. And this is just from one, we changed the land use and it had all of these effects. Now we want to see how are we going to go about actually characterizing the degree to which we impacted the stream system. And so oftentimes stream ecologists will use something called an index of biological integrity. We're simply saying that we're just trying to come up with kind of one number that combines a bunch of different metrics to provide us a measure of how a stream system's health is compared to a reference condition. So essentially we're just saying, let's say we had a pristine environment, how is the stream compared to that pristine stream? So usually it's a reference to something else. It's an index, right? Indexed against a pristine stream. They can help us not only measure the health of aquatic ecosystems, but they can help us also pinpoint particular stressors, and they can help us define a bunch of management approaches for addressing those stressors, and they can also help us essentially monitor, if we are trying to restore something or remediate something, they can help us monitor how we're doing. And that's, you know, here at Holden, we have mining, and we have some biomonitoring being done to track, how is the stream health? And are the remediation efforts helping? That's an important thing. And that's where something like an IBI for short, for index of biotic integrity, that's where these things come in handy. Now there's a bunch of different kinds of IBIs. Some involve bugs, some involve fish, some involve plants. I thought I'd just talk to you about bugs because we're going to be talking about bugs tomorrow too. And bugs are really cool. And we just saw this one. Amy and I, the naturalists, were down on Ten Mile Creek, and we just saw some of these big monsters. One of them actually, she picked up a rock, and it kind of leapt off the rock, and she jumped because it was so big. And I think she was afraid she might lose a finger. But so benthic macroinvertebrates here. It's kind of a fancy way of saying benthic just means bottom dwelling. Macro means you can see them with the naked eye, and invertebrate just means it doesn't have a backbone. So it's just a bug that doesn't have a backbone that lives on the bottom, and you can see it. You don't need a microscope, essentially. And so here's just a smattering of some typical bugs you might find in many streams around here. And so why use bugs? Why not just go out and just take a sample? We've got a whole bunch of fancy equipment now. We've got these multi-probes we can throw in a stream and collect a bunch of data all at once. We've got technology, right? Why rely on bugs? Well, when we go out and we take a sample and take it back to the lab, that's useful information, but it only tells us what happened at that exact moment in time. So we just know how is the stream on this exact date at this exact time in this exact place. Now, bugs are pretty handy because they're affected by a lot of different things. So, you know, usually when we're taking a water sample, we're really only looking at the water chemistry. But bugs can also tell us a lot about the physical habitat and maybe some changes to the physical habitat. And they can tell us a lot about the other biotic conditions that might be affecting them, not just the chemistry. So they can integrate multiple things. And they do migrate a little bit, but not much. So they're kind of there in space. And they provide us a pretty good indicator of what the local conditions are like in a stream. So in other words, they're not escaping pollution. Other animals might not be so great because their home range is so large, it's hard to really get an idea of if they are impacted, it's hard to know exactly where it's from. And so, you know, as Joe had talked about yesterday, one of the reasons why streams in particular are one of the most impacted biomes is longitudinal impacts. So anything that happens upstream is going to affect something downstream. And so they kind of integrate or combine all of those upstream cumulative impacts. So that's also a valuable thing. So they're kind of stuck in space and they're acting as kind of indicators or filters of everything coming downstream. The land use changes from upstream, the chemical changes from upstream, etc. And so, we already covered that. They're also really important for the food web. So, like, if we know how they're doing, it tells us a lot about how the other creatures in the stream system are likely doing as well. And you know, they're pretty easy to sample and identify, and they're fun. You know, you don't need much money to do this. You don't need really expensive equipment. You can go out there with a homemade net, go get some window screen, you know, stitch it up, or use some zip ties, attach it to some dowels, and go out there and kick in the stream a little bit. And you'll get a ton of bugs, and you just need a bucket and a cheap microscope or magnifying glass, and you can identify most bugs down to the family level, which is pretty good. So, recall, the land has changed the water quality, and it changed the habitat, right? And these bugs are going to be useful to us because we're going to talk first about how they're useful for detecting pollution. And so what stream ecologists and entomologists have done is they've basically taken all of these different bugs and they've ranked them according to their tolerance to pollution, tolerance to disturbance. And that's handy. And then we've also ranked them, or we've also categorized them into these different functional feeding groups, which is just a way of saying, you know, what do they eat and how? And that's important because that's a good indicator of any physical changes to the habitat. So here we're getting an idea of, chemical changes, you know. And here we're getting more a picture of changes to the habitat. So here's our tolerance index that I mentioned. So here we got, you know, a stonefly, like I pointed out earlier, this is a perlidae, a common stonefly, big, bulky sucker. He's a predator. He likes to run around and eat other mayflies, eat other stoneflies, he'll eat anything, really. Several times I've caught them, I was telling the naturalist, I've caught them in a sample, and you would think that they would be disturbed. They'd be like, I'm a little stressed out. I'm in this bucket, this guy's shining a light on me, you know, he's picking me up with like a spoon and moving me from petri dish to petri dish. I don't know about this. They'll just continue eating. Like, there's just like nothing, they just carry on like normal. And they'll just, I've seen them just eat mayflies right in front of me on a petri dish. I'm like, wow, you think you'd be a little concerned about, you know, this giant who's staring at you through a magnifying glass. But these guys tend to be very, very sensitive, relatively speaking, to a lot of other bugs in terms of changes to stream chemistry, like temperature, dissolved oxygen, heavy metals, other things like that. So these are the really sensitive ones. And these guys up here are the more tolerant ones, typically speaking. So leeches, pretty tolerant to disturbance. Midges here, and certain kinds of caddisfly are pretty tolerant. They can handle big drops in DO, they can handle some spikes in temperature, they can handle a lot of other pollutants in their system. So, you know, here we might rank these with a zero, and here is a 10 out of 10. Oof, these guys can really handle, they're very tolerant of disturbance. So here's some more examples here. Stoneflies, water penny beetles, mayflies, these are typically associated with higher quality stream systems. And each of these ends up with its own little number in terms of its ability to tolerate these things without, you know, essentially dying. And then there's kind of a middle group here. These are somewhat pollutant tolerant. And here's, so that's going to indicate a stream that's moderately impacted. And so damselflies and drag, so, you know, you've all seen adult forms of dragonflies. Here's what their larval form looks like when they're in a stream system. So, you know, you've pretty much seen probably all of these flies before, or their adult forms before. What you probably haven't seen is their larval or pupal forms. And so all these guys, pretty much, not all of them, but most of them here, metamorphose, right? And so this caddisfly is in the Trichoptera order. And Trichoptera just means, essentially, they have hairy wings. So Terra just means wings, and Tricho means hairy, hairy wings. And then you got black flies here, which we saw quite a few, and I don't know if you've been bit by any around here, but we saw where their little eggs are and their larvae are. Plenty of them, so. Didn't see a lot of mosquito larvae, though. Saw a few, but not too many. And then here's our pollution tolerant group, and now it's much larger than this. Again, this is just a subsample. You know, some snails is a pouch snail, and some snails essentially have pseudo lungs that actually come out of the water, and they get a little bit of air, and they store it in a little pocket, and then go back down. And some of them actually have gills. These are the ones that have a pseudo lung. And they're pretty tolerant of disturbance. And same with the midges, like I mentioned. And if you see aquatic worms, also, and then of course what I mentioned earlier, leeches. Now, just because you see a leech or a worm or a midge fly in a sample, that doesn't mean it's a bad quality stream. It's just when they predominate, essentially, when they kind of start taking over, that's when you know you might have a problem. And like I mentioned, these last guys here, these are all how we're all ranking them in terms of their pollution tolerance. Well, we also have, you know, these functional feeding groups I mentioned, which is an indicator of any physical changes to the habitat. And so I mentioned predators. Well, that's a functional feeding group. They eat other bugs, essentially. And there's a whole bunch of different ones here. Here's a subset. Shredders, they do exactly what their name implies. They have adaptations, mouth parts and mandibles and arms and things that allow them to grab a hold of large things, leaves, sticks, that sort of thing, and literally shred them, break them down, eat them. And what they're mostly eating is a lot of the algae growing on those large, kind of coarse particulate organic matter is what typically what they're called. And you typically find shredders further up in a watershed. And I'll show you a little bit more about what I mean in a second here. And you also have, you know, filtering collectors, for instance, down here. And these guys can be really neat. Some of my favorite bugs are like net spinning caddisflies. And these caddis back here, like here's a caddis, this is not a case builder, but here's a caddisfly, for instance, right here. And they look like, essentially when they hatch in their adult form, they look like little moths. I had one fly in my ear one time. I don't recommend it. He got stuck up in there for a few days.
Ooh.
And was beating away on my eardrum. I think he was trying to get to safety and thought the further he went up into that dark place, the better. And that made for a short fishing day for me because it was hard to continue fishing with a bug in my ear. Yeah.
I had that happen one time to somebody, and my suggestion was take a flashlight.
Oh, yeah.
Because it was darker out, a little darker out.
Did it work?
And it did the trick.
Well, it turns out this little light, what kind of creature was that?
Some kind of fly, mosquito, moth,
is that right?
Whatever.
Well, he got stuck. I guess I have some earwax up there. And I had to go to the doctor to get it out. He had a syringe about this big. Interesting fellow. He had he'd been in practice for probably 50 years, an older gentleman. And he extracted this thing, took quite a few plunges, extracts this caddisfly, and then goes over and takes out this big envelope, and then starts flipping through it and finds a spot, I guess for my name, I don't know if it was alphabetized or how he did it. But I looked over and he had a collection of all the different creatures he's pulled out of people's ears over his career. And it was quite an extensive collection, so I added to his collection. I don't know what he did with it, but in any case, here are these caddis fly here. And they can build these cool little nets. And what they do is they're kind of, I don't say farmers exactly, but they'll sit there and they'll build these little cases where they can hide from predation. And then outside of their case, they'll build a little net. And that net catches this fine particular organic matter and algae and phytoplankton and zooplankton in it. And they just kind of come out and they eat and then they go back in. And they come out and they eat and they sort of graze on whatever happens to be caught in the net. But there's a lot of fascinating creatures at the point. And they all have different adaptations that allow them to eat different things. So they all have their different little niche. And so if we change the physical habitat, around the stream, we can change which, like the composition, which and how many of the different bugs we might expect to find. Now this, what you're seeing here, is called the river continuum concept. And this is kind of an elegant way of looking at a stream system. And what we're looking at here is essentially distance along a stream. And so, you know, this could be thought of in terms of, we'll just say miles, for instance. And, you know, here's the relative channel width is down here. So essentially, we're up in the headwaters up here. And as we get further and further down, it turns in, we'll just pretend this is the Mississippi down here. And maybe this is one of these smaller streams, little tributaries that you've seen maybe pouring down, creating a little waterfall. Essentially, what we're looking at is a gradient of energies. Of energy inputs into the stream here that describes this system here. So up in the headwaters, you're going to have a pretty dense canopy, a lot of shade, and a lot of what they call alloctonous inputs, meaning energy inputs from outside of the system. And did anybody have any idea what I mean by that in this context? Energy inputs from outside the system, like what might dominate here?
Organic debris, leaves.
Yeah, leaves, sticks, all, you know, pine cones, all this stuff falling in. It's just raining all the time into that system. Well, that's a huge input of energy. And that type of energy dictates the kind of creatures that can feed on it, that can thrive on it. And so up in the headwaters, you can't really see it that well, but these are the shredders. They tend to, maybe not dominate, but they tend to be a substantial portion of what you might expect to find in a smaller headwater stream. Because they have the adaptations that allow them to tear apart and chew on and extract energy from this large particular organic matter, these leaves and sticks and things. And you also have a fair amount of these are collectors as well. And you got some grazers up there too. But as we move further and further down, the stream starts to widen a bit, and you get less of a canopy cover, still have some. But all of a sudden, we have, as we start transitioning, going down, 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 we have a transition from a lock that is inputs from the canopy to another kind of input. Anybody got any ideas what that might be? Get further and further down, starts opening, opening.
More sunlight?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. All of a sudden, the sun starts to dominate. Mm-hmm. And so you get more phytoplankton, you get more what they call periphyton, which is just attached aquatic vegetation. So all of a sudden, the vegetation in the channel really starts to be a big source of energy. And so instead of a lochthonous, it's autochthonous. Auto. It's energy from within, created from within the system. And so, as you get more and more light, well, as I said, you get more plants, more phytoplankton. Well, then you get a switch now. Instead of having a huge amount of shredders, now you get more of these collectors. Maybe more of these net spinning caddis. You can't really see them that well, but right here, for instance, those little net spinners. They start to take advantage of the fact that all these shredders have done all this work up here, breaking down the large stuff, and now it's much finer. And it's drifting downstream in large quantities. In addition, you also have a lot more phytoplankton and zooplankton and things that are able to survive here and then be caught in their nets and eaten. And then we move further and further and further downstream, and now not only has everything been, the organic matter been broken down, and the stream is much, much wider, emitting in far more sunlight, but the substrate is completely changed. Here we've got a lot of large cobbles and boulders, and so you have a lot of different species of bugs that have adaptations that allow them to exist in a high velocity environment. They need to be able to hold on to rocks really tight, otherwise they're going to get swept away. Well, down here, it's a bunch of kind of, you know, again, we're kind of pretending this is Mississippi, it's basically a bunch of sandy, very fine, silty substrate or bed material that you might find down in here. And so you end up having a lot of creatures that are filter feeders, like clams, mussels, and things. They're filtering out a lot of this fine matter, and a lot of burrowing insects. So you end up with this kind of continual changes in the bug assemblage, essentially, as we move downstream, dictated and to a large extent by changes in the energy inputs and changes in the physical habitat that you might expect to find, like the boulders transitioning to the finer substrates.
Is water temperature a big deal as it gets
wider,
shallower?
Yes, for sure. And as you, you know, this canopy cover is providing a lot of valuable shade. And that's keeping things cooler. So you have species that typically don't tolerate warmer conditions. And as you get further and further down, now all of a sudden you have, and by the way, I should point out that changes in, as I said, these bugs are really important parts of the food web and the aquatic ecosystems. Well, then you get concomitant or necessary changes in the species that feed on them, that depend on them. So what we're looking at here is changes in the fish communities, dictated in part by changes in what happens to the bugs. Any questions about the river continuum concept? Does that make sense? It's kind of a rough overview. But part of the point here is that if we come in and change something to do with the physical habitat up here, say get rid of the canopy because some sort of human-caused fire or development, we get rid of that canopy, well, we would expect them to see a pretty big change in the bugs. So it's an indicator of what happened to the habitat here. And in the Puget Sound region, you know, these IBIs are region-specific. So, you know, and also I should point out with the river continuum concept, you know, you got to compare apples to apples. So, you know, if you're going to look at a headwater system and going to use an index of biotic integrity, you want to use one that's kind of reflective of the fact that it's indicating the health of a a lower order stream system or a smaller stream, because you know you wouldn't want to compare this system to this system. Those aren't apples to apples, right? So the index of biotic integrity is region specific, like bioregion specific, but also a bit specific to where you are in the stream system. And so in the Puget Sound region, especially the western area here of Washington State, for example, they kind of integrate all of these different metrics into kind of one number. And so here we're kind of looking like, okay, well, what percent of our sample of bugs that we go out and we collect in a net in a stream, what percent of those are actually tolerant to disturbance? Well, if it's a high percentage, that's probably not great. What if, you know, and then same thing with intolerant. You know, the more intolerant that we have, when we talk about richness, we're just talking about how many different orders or families or genuses or species of bugs do we find in our sample. If it makes up a large portion of the sample, well, we probably get pretty good water quality. What about just the total species richness? You know, usually higher diversity streams are in better condition, right? Now this Plecoptera here, or stonefly, this big ugly looking guys that we saw earlier, and remember I said Terra here is wings, and this Pleco here is basically referring to plated, so they look kind of armored, you know, is what essentially that means if you're looking at sort of the etymology of it. You know, as I said, they're very sensitive, so the more of those that you have, and the more species that you have, probably the better your system's going to be. Ephemoptera, mayfly, is a very common one, and a lot of fishermen know what that means if they're fly fishermen. And, you know, this is ephemero, just means they're not around very long. They're winged creatures that don't, you know, in the adult form, when they have wings, kind of around for about a day, you know, maybe a week, depends on the species. And there are certain species here that are actually very good at indicating heavy metal, the presence of heavy metals. And we'll talk a little bit more about why that might be handy in a second. So anyways, you've got all these different ways of measuring. When you take a sample and you count all the bugs and you ID them under microscopes and everything, you can summarize them all and then rank them all and then come up with essentially one number at the end. And oftentimes what we end up looking to do is kind of come up with this kind of dose-response relationship where we have this benthic IBI here on the Y and then some sort of human disturbance down here, you know, and just say low to high. In this case, we're just measuring it as a function of impervious surface area. And you can see, well, the more impervious surface you have, which is really just a surrogate for development, right? The more development we have, the lower the indice score would be at the end. And so if we look at what we've seen around the Puget Sound region, does anybody see any patterns? You know, each of these dots indicate an area that is being biomonitored by the Department of Ecology in Washington State. So each of these little dots, and the green ones are a little harder to see, they're smaller, they are areas of low concern as indicated by the index of biotic integrity. Yellow being moderate, red being not so good. So any dot you see is an indicator that they've done some biomonitoring there and have ranked it. You see any kind of spatial pattern? I kind of wish I had zoomed out more, because if you zoom out more, you see it's pretty green over here.
There's no development up there.
Oh, what do you know? And then as you get closer and closer to Seattle proper, things start to go yellow to red here. Yeah.
So let's say there's a green dot right next to a red dot, like almost inside, like on the bottom.
Uh-huh.
Could there be any reason why that is?
Sure, I mean, they're very localized impacts, right? Mm-hmm. So they're probably two stream systems. I don't know exactly which ones those are, but if we had the mapper up, maybe, you know, you seem to know
it's
the
geography. It's south of Covington, and it's southeast of Black Diamond.
Yeah.
You know, Cumberland. Okay, so Cumberland Creek is an old mine, and it's probably hitting another creek that's isn't in the watershed that Cumberland Creek goes through.
Yes. So. It's most likely that the Green would be a tributary, you know, or relatively unimpacted tributary, and maybe this one here, the red one, is most likely a highly impacted one, so they're pretty much, you know, right on top of each other, really close, where they're monitoring, like, essentially where the tributary comes in, and then measuring the main stem. And apparently the main stem is not doing great. It's most likely what that indicates. But yeah, I mean, just looking at a macro scale, you can see just, you know, how development can really, really change the stream health. And so we talk about what's been going on locally here at Holden Village in terms of the mine and mining. You know, a lot of you are quite familiar, probably more familiar with what happened here than I. This is my first time here. But, you know, opened in 1938. It was in operation for about 19 years. Copper prices crash. Boom, the mine folds. Boom, they sell it. They sell it for a dollar to Lutheran Church. And unfortunately, it was designated a Superfund site by the EPA. But fortunately, we actually have a mining company left holding the bag this time, which is not often the case. Usually, they declare bankruptcy and disappear somewhere and then leave the state or the tribes or somebody holding the bag and having to deal with all the environmental cleanup. And Rio Tinto is doing a pretty good job, I would say, so far, it appears. And we'll get more into that in a second here. Now, some of the mining impacts are 57 miles of underground tunnels. That, you know, they did a lot of work up here. 300,000 cubic yards of waste rock, 8.5 million tons of tailings. Tailings just being basically what is left over from the mining process. And I was just trying to put it in some kind of concept that you guys could, you know, wrap your mind around. You take all the Washington State residents, that's about 2,300 pounds per resident. That's about a ton per resident in the state. And so about, you know, 60 football fields it was scattered over. Now, they've done a lot of remediation of it since then. But, you know, we've had a lot of acid mine drainage resulting from it. And essentially, acid mine drainage is a lot of the tailings that they pulled out and exposed to the air and to water in particular contain pyrite or other sulfur-bearing minerals. And as water moves through those sulfur-bearing minerals, you end up with some chemical reactions happening, and you end up with essentially the water at the end of that having very low pH, so it's acidic. And that acidity then draws out the metal, leaches out the metals. And so you end up with a lot of metals being deposited into Railroad Creek. And so we're affecting about 10 miles of Railroad Creek. And don't forget, all of those sediments that got transported over the last, you know, 70 years down into Lake Chelan. And so you got about 10 acres of the sediment in Lake Chelan that are contaminated as well. And the Department of Ecology has been doing some biomonitoring to try to track how Railroad Creek is doing, essentially. And they've got this really handy kind of story map here. And, you know, if anybody's interested, I can pass this a website along to you where you can kind of explore this yourself. And just real quickly, here's a map indicating they've been looking at periphyton attached aquatic vegetation. And they've been wondering, you know, what are the metal concentrations? This is a map of what the concentrations look like for copper. It's a copper mine. And as we get further and further downstream, it's blue up here because it's upstream. And then as we get down to the downstream side of the creek or of the mine, you can see, well, it's pretty hot. Got a lot more down there. It makes sense, which you would expect to find. But what does that mean for the biota? Are we able to detect any impact on the living creatures in the stream system? And another thing that they looked at too, and they actually looked at a bunch of different things here, aluminum, arsenic, cadmium, copper, iron. They have all these things mapped out, which is really slick. But the cadmium here, you can see also, this is the mine, above the mine, below the mine. Going up, 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 spike right below the mine. I'm just picking out two of these, copper and cadmium, both having pretty definitive longitudinal gradients, increasing significantly below the mine. And so in terms of what that's resulted in terms of the actual biota, you can see here's the IBI score relative to the concentration of zinc, of copper in the periphyton tissues. And what do you what do you know? We have a very definitive negative relationship. So the more copper or the more zinc that we have in the periphyte, and remember, a lot of these bugs are eating the periphyte. They're grazers, they're scrapers. They literally scrape off periphyton and they eat it. Well, they're getting contaminated by it. And not, some of these aren't so tolerant to it, and so they're being reflected, it's being reflected in the decline in the IBI score. And then think about how that propagates up the food web. And, you know, not just looking at IBIs, they also have been looking at other physical changes to the habitat, so like canopy cover. Pretty good above, moderately impacted at the mine, and then quite a bit lower below the mine. And again, that is going to translate into change. If you're thinking back to the river continuum concept and energy inputs, that's going to have a pretty definitive impact on the stream and the ecosystem. And one last thing here, or two last things. Here is the kind of overall IBI score from 2015 versus 2018. And you're looking above, at the mine, below the mine. And here's this kind of, they threw this in here as an indicator that it's degraded versus non-degraded. This is their kind of threshold. But they said, for this area, we expect this to be a pretty good threshold here to indicate whether the system has actually been degraded. So again, things are looking pretty good above the mine in 2015, 18, and 19. All these years look pretty darn good, pretty green, well above the threshold. Then we get, you know, partway into the mine, all of a sudden we have a pretty big dip on average. Now, 2015, we also have fire, right? And so what kind of partly what we're seeing here is a break right here where above the fire, you know, did impact it up here, probably not as much. I'm not as familiar. Maybe somebody here can enlighten me in terms of the extent of the fire. But I think you know, it did impact a fair amount of area upstream of the mine. And I think partly what we can take away from this is, number one, you see some pretty definitive impacts from the mine. And you see that most likely the 2015 fire event didn't really change the biota much in here. But it really impacted the biota at the mine and downstream of the mine, perhaps reflecting cumulative impacts. So they might have been less resilient to the disturbance of a fire. So when a fire did happen here, the ecosystem couldn't absorb that impact. And so you had a much more definitive drop and then a slow rebound up into above this degraded threshold. So you know, another take home is that, you know, it looks like, if you're looking at least in 2019, that we're above this degraded threshold, even below the mine. So it appears, now if we had the data, which would be great, if you go back to 1960 or 70, we'd probably see some pretty interesting trends. We would likely see a slow improvement over time, especially since they began a remediation efforts. At least that's what you would expect. Yeah. Oh, no, I'm sorry. I thought you had a question. So yeah, speaking of remediation efforts, they're doing a bunch of different things to try to fix what they broke, essentially. Spending a lot of different money on wetland remediation. They've got essentially a groundwater barrier, a big polymer wall that they put in to try to separate the waters that are flowing through the tailings from the creek itself to prevent it from actually being transported in the stream and downstream to Lake Chelan. And so, you know, we're monitoring, not we, but we as a state are monitoring how these remediation efforts are affecting the stream. And so far, things look pretty good. But again, probably less resilient based on what we just saw. And so with that, take any questions that anybody has. I'm happy to answer. And also, plug for tomorrow, we're going to be out kicking around the stream, splashing around, looking at bugs, using nets and some magnifying glasses, and we'll probably try to calculate our own IBI and see what we come up with. Maybe you can, yeah.
You didn't, I realize plants are for animals, we always used to talk about years ago, especially in Boy Scouts, if you saw watercress, that was a sign of some pretty good water, usually be by a spring. There are other key plants that'll just at a glance will give you a good indicator of water quality.
Yeah, they do have indices for plants as well, and some plants are indicative of disturbance more than others. And yes, they do that. Mm-hmm. For sure. Did you have questions about that? No. Okay. Any other questions? Yeah.
So you're using bugs basically as kind of a benchmark.
Yeah.
What exactly is it a benchmark for, though? You're measuring the stream's ability to support certain types of macroinvertebrates. What is the result of that ability to support a variety or not a variety of macroinvertebrates?
Yeah. So we're trying to compare what the current state of the stream is to a reference or pristine condition, what it kind of should be before human impact.
So what are the characteristics of that pristine condition other than its ability to carry bugs? Does that make sense?
Okay, yeah, so you expect this pristine habitat to be able to provide all of those ecosystem services that I kind of mentioned earlier, and to provide the climate regulation, to provide natural nutrient cycling in an undisturbed fashion. And so, when you're comparing the current state of the system to this supposed pristine condition, which they find these relatively undisturbed systems. Now, there is no undisturbed system at this point because we most likely, have some climate change happening and as well as other global effects. But we still have some metric or some reference point to compare it to. And so those systems tend to be more resilient to disturbance. They have more biodiversity, and they produce more fish, which is something that a lot of fishermen are into, and a lot of people who like to eat fish are into. They just provide a lot more provisioning services, regulating services. All those things are in better condition and more productive and more resilient. Does that answer your question?
Yeah, thank you.
Okay, yeah, sure. I saw one more hand.
Probably about 25 years ago, or maybe 30 years ago, I had inquired about, and I saw that it wasn't looking good in the railroad creek up in here. And I was wondering how it was affecting the lake. And at that time, the folks that I did inquire about two or three times, maybe, what they were saying was that whoever was checking was saying there wasn't much of a problem or it wasn't causing a problem in the lake in any way they were checking on it. I wonder, in your research to do this, did you run across much of the documentation with regard to how it is affecting the lake, in the last few years or even now?
That's a good question. I know that like I mentioned, they definitely are monitoring the sediments, and they definitely know the sediments are hot. I'm not aware of them treating those sediments. I don't think there's any plan that I'm aware of right now to do anything about the contamination in the lake itself. It is a big lake. Case, I think it's a dilution is the solution situation. Okay. I think you can see localized impacts for sure.
Yeah.
But it's as an ecosystem in the lake,
smaller
probably area. Not going to have a huge impact.
Okay.
Would I think twice about eating a fish caught near the kind of river delta? Yeah, maybe I might. You can see that. I don't know. I'd like to look to see in terms of the concentrations. Because we got biomagnification as well. It's not as severe in a species like a trout, but they do bioaccumulate and biomagnify, pollutants like heavy metals. If I was a woman or pregnant, I might not eat too many if I got them really close. So, did you have a question, Sam?
Sure. Where are you meeting for the river class tomorrow?
Oh, I think we're gonna meet here.
Meet here
and then go.
Okay.
I think that was the idea because I think that's what's listed.
I did. I'm certainly not in science or anything like this, but on public television, hearing too about actually the transfer of plastics now in the atmosphere.
Yes.
Is that being shown at anywhere?
Oh, yes.
Impact
everywhere.
Here?
All the freshwater ecosystems are showing high amounts of microplastics, in, especially in anything that filters. They show it quite a lot. So all the snails and the mollusks and the filter feeders and things that they're in the tissues of fish, every living creature for the most part that ingests anything or breathes water ends up having microplastics somewhere in their system. Typically it's isolated in their guts, but what are the implications of those microplastics that we're investigating that right now? We don't really fully understand what those implications might be.
And that might even affect these insects that are...
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, we don't... We just kind of discovered this issue, and it's kind of a recent one. Like, oh, crap. In the last 5-10 years, it's really come to the forefront, and now people are just finding microplastics everywhere. Of course, it's the marine environment. We've been hearing a lot about that. But also, absolutely, in rivers, there is research being done right now to try to understand... What are the implications? Because these things, as they break down, there's lots of byproducts. And they also, of course, take up space. And they don't necessarily digest well. And so there's a lot of potential implications. And I suspect if we did a quick Google Scholar search, we'd probably come up with several hundred papers in the last 5 years in freshwater ecosystems, all indicating most likely some form of impact. So it's a great question. I'd like to actually know more about the current status.
Do they have data going back to like the 70s or 80s in the Railroad Creek area?
Not that I'm aware of. They didn't do a lot of this biomonitoring back then. This is sort of a newer thing. And it's not brand new, but it's certainly new. It's probably 30, 40 years old. Probably not so much 60s, 70s. They probably started doing something like this in the 80s. But it really took off more... in the 90s and after. So we probably don't have a whole lot of data going back, but I'm sure the Department of Ecology could answer that.
I'm sure that the stream was in worse shape in the 80s.
Yeah.
I guess. But it's interesting because I've been fishing the last couple of days, and as a kid I fished from the bridge down around the corner. And just have been doing that the last day. Daughter and I walked down. We fished all the whole age of fish.
Yeah, sure.
And the fish are much smaller. There's no large fish. They're all these small cutthroat. I don't know if there was any naturalist that could say, hey, here's what happened. All the big fish got wiped out. Replanted with cutthroat, or I don't know what. But why that would be.
Have you noticed, it's hard to recall, 30 years ago, precisely what a place looked like. Do you recall, like...
Some of the holes were the same, like in the big rock, couple of rocks out there. And
Is there large woody debris in there? Is enough habitat structure?
It was similar.
Has that changed?
It actually looked similar. I mean, it's surprising how similar the stream looked on this side of the bank. Now the opposite, the other side of the bank.
Yeah,
different, right? And better, because it used to be there was tailing at this and really close. The fish are all really, really small.
Interesting.
Observation.
Yeah. I mean, that's
from one day.
Yeah, usually I would attribute that to a lack of habitat. We ate them all.
They cooked them up for me. So that's why I tick.
Well, you're not the only one. I've talked to a couple other folks who said they went fishing. They're like, no, it was good. I caught a lot, but they were awful small.
Yeah.
And I've actually noticed that at a lot of places in California that I've been fishing, I catch a ton of fish.
Yep.
But they're all 6 to 5, to 4 inches, so small most of the time they can't even get their mouth around the fly.
Right.
Which is actually good because I don't want to hook them,
Right.
But I have noticed that. And, I'm not a fisheries biologist, but I would like to know why, because I want to know where the big ones are.
Where'd they all go?
What's that?
We're seeing the same thing on Heart Lake. They're all just...
Much smaller than they used to be.
Yeah.
Huh. I'm not sure. Something must be preventing them from reaching a larger size.
Yeah. And maybe we just fished all the big ones out.
It's possible. I don't know how. I presume this is fairly well fished by the sheer number of people coming up here. But I don't know how many people are catching release versus actually keep.
Well, and the other question too, could, just pondering, is perhaps this is the more natural size that they should be, and maybe the larger size was an indicator of something that was unhealthy.
That's possible.
Just thinking out loud.
Right. I gotcha. And it's certainly possible that you would end up in a situation where you'd have so few juveniles and only a few very large adults. Mm-hmm. And that might not be ideal because that's not necessarily great for population sustainability. Sure. If the juveniles aren't surviving and only adults are, something must be stressing out, or a habitat structure change has happened such that the juveniles no longer have refugia that protects them from predation. So maybe all the birds are eating all the juveniles. Maybe, you know, because they don't have any habitat cover for the juvenile ones. So that's a potential indicator that, hey, something's wrong with this habitat because there's nothing to sustain this population once the adults are gone. But yeah, I thought I saw one more hand.
Another question. So one of the early ideas for what to do with the tailings before the mine even opened was to just dump them directly into Lake Chelan. And I'm curious if you think, knowing what we know now, if that actually would have been better. You know, put 1,000 feet of water on top of them. Just let them hang out down there forever.
My initial reaction is, that sounds like a bad idea.
Some other people had that thought in the 30s, so.
Did they really?
Yeah, they ended up doing this, right?
Rather than
just slurring them down into the lake.
Yeah.
But I wonder if that would have actually just sealed them under there and avoided all of this mess.
Sealed them under.
Kind of like, don't dredge commitment being to Tacoma.
Yeah, right, just let them sit there under 1,000 feet of water.
Well, that would be really risky. I mean, that could just be make whole Lake Chelan a Superfund site or something.
Yeah, it's quite possible. I mean, the chemical reactions that would take place 1,000 feet down would certainly be different than what would take place up here. Because there's a much more highly oxygenated environment, etc. And I don't know what the implications of the differences in those chemical reactions might have been in terms of how much of the metals that they didn't extract would have been pulled out and then potentially made bioavailable. Because you can have lots of things like the methylation of mercury. You have mercury and then you methylate it, then it's way more bioavailable, and then it gets taken up in the food chain and biomagnified the whole way up. And all of a sudden, you might have a bunch of radioactive trout, and actually, I'm exaggerating there, but it's possible it could have been worse. We'd have to know more about the chemistry of these particular tailings in that environment at those temperatures, and then look at how the food web might transport any of the chemicals that would be released 1,000 feet down. How would they get back up? We'd have to take a look at that. It's an interesting idea. And perhaps it might have been, if we studied it and compared it, it might have been overall lower impact. But it seems like a bad idea.
Well, it all seems like a bad idea.
Yeah. Any other thoughts? Should we all go get some ice cream?
Thank you.
Appreciate it.
Is there any recommendations as far as footwear or whatever tomorrow?
Anything that you don't mind getting wet in, but you don't have to get in the stream. We're going to bring the bugs out anyway. This isn't mandatory that you get in the water. It's just if you want to, you can get down there and kick some rocks, or at the very least, you can grab some rocks and pull them over and take a look at
from
them.
From the side.
Yeah, from the side. You don't have to go out.
Yeah, but if you want to get in the river,
it'll be hot. I hear it's going to be 90. So there's that. So bring some sunscreen and a hat, And we will be taking the bugs probably over to some tables in the shade. So there is that. So we're not going to, because it makes it pretty painful trying to identify small things in a blazing sun. Any other thoughts?
Thank you.
Yeah, you're very welcome. Thanks, everybody, for coming.